Side 4. The City and the Stars and the Sands of Mars by Arthur C. Clarke. Continuing with The City and the Stars on page 125. He knew that the answer involved technologies that relied on the manipulation of space itself. But how one could lock an atom rigidly in the position defined by data stored elsewhere was something he could not begin to explain. On a sudden inspiration, he pointed to the invisible dome protecting them from the night. "Tell me how this roof above our heads is created by that box you're sitting on," he answered, "and then I'll explain how the eternity circuits work." Hilvar laughed. "I suppose it's a fair comparison. You'd have to ask one of our field theory experts if you wanted to know that. I certainly couldn't tell you." The reply made Alvin very thoughtful. So there were still men in this who understood how their machines worked. That was more than could be said of Diaspora. Thus they talked and argued, until presently Hilvar said, "I'm tired. What about you? Are you going to sleep?" Alvin rubbed his still weary limbs. "I'd like to," he confessed, "but I'm not sure I can. It still seems a strange custom to me."
"It is a good deal more than a custom," smiled Hilvar. "I have been told that it was once a necessity to every human being. We still like to sleep at least once a day, even if only for a few hours. During that time, the body refreshes itself, and the mind as well."
"Does no one in Diaspora ever sleep?"
"Only on very rare occasions," said Alvin. "Jezerak, my tutor, has done it once or twice, after he had made some exceptional mental effort. A well-designed body should have no need for such rest periods. We did away with them millions of years ago." Even as he spoke these rather boastful words, his actions belied them. He felt a weariness such as he had never before known. It seemed to spread from his calves and thighs until it flowed through all his body. There was nothing unpleasant about the sensation, rather the reverse. Hilvar was watching him with an amused smile, and Alvin had enough faculties left to wonder if his companion was exercising any of his mental powers upon him. If so, he did not object in the least. The light flooding down from the metal pair overhead sank to a faint glow, but the warmth it was radiating continued unabated. By the last flicker of light, Alvin's drowsy mind registered a curious fact which he would have to inquire about in the morning. Hilvar had stripped off his clothes, and for the first time, Alvin saw how much the two branches of the human race had diverged. Some of the changes were merely ones of emphasis or proportion, but others, such as the external genitals and the presence of teeth, nails, and definite body hair, were more fundamental. What puzzled him most of all, however, was the curious small hollow in the pit of Hilvar's stomach. When, some days later, he suddenly remembered the subject, it took a good deal of explaining. By the time that Hilvar had made the functions of the navel quite clear, he had uttered many thousands of words and drawn half a dozen diagrams. And both he and Alvin had made a great step forward in understanding the basis of each other's cultures. Chapter 12. The night was at its deepest when Alvin woke. Something had disturbed him, some whisper of sound that had crept into his mind despite the endless thunder of the falls. He sat up in the darkness, straining his eyes across the hidden land, while with indrawn breath he listened to the drumming roar of the water and the softer, more fugitive sounds of the creatures of the night. Nothing was visible. The starlight was too dim to reveal the miles of country that lay hundreds of feet below. Only a jagged line of darker night eclipsing the stars told of the mountains on the southern horizon. In the darkness beside him, Alvin heard his companion roll over and sit up.
"What is it?" came a whispered voice.
"I thought I heard a noise."
"What sort of noise?"
"I don't know. Perhaps it was just imagination." There was a silence while two pairs of eyes peered out into the mystery of the night. Then suddenly, Hilvar caught Alvin's arm.
"Look!" he whispered.
Far to the south glowed a solitary point of light, too low in the heavens to be a star. It was a brilliant white, tinged with violet, and even as they watched, it began to climb the spectrum of intensity, until the eye could no longer bear to look upon it. Then it exploded, and it seemed as if lightning had struck below the rim of the world. For a brief instant, the mountains and the land they encircled were etched with fire against the darkness of the night. Ages later, came the ghost of a far-off explosion, and in the woods below a sudden wind stirred among the trees. It died away swiftly, and one by one the routed stars crept back into the sky. For the second time in his life, Alvin knew fear. It was not as personal and imminent as it had been in the Chamber of the Moving Ways, when he had made the decision that took him to Lys. Perhaps it was awe rather than fear. He was looking into the face of the unknown, and it was as if he had already sensed that out there beyond the mountains was something he must go to meet. "What was that?" he whispered at length. There was a pause so long that he repeated the question. "I am trying to find out," said Hilvar, and was silent again. Alvin guessed what he was doing, and did not interrupt his friend's silent quest. Presently Hilvar gave a little sigh of disappointment. "Everyone is asleep," he said. "There was no one who could tell me. We must wait until morning, unless I wake one of my friends, and I would not like to do that unless it is really important." Alvin wondered what Hilvar would consider a matter of real importance. He was just going to suggest, a little sarcastically, that this might well merit interrupting someone's sleep. Before he could make the proposal, Hilvar spoke again. "I've just remembered," he said, rather apologetically. "It's a long time since I came here, and I'm not quite certain about my bearings. But that must be Shalmarain." "Shalmarain? Does it still exist?" "Yes, I'd almost forgotten. Serranus once told me that the fortress lies in those mountains. Of course it's been in ruins for ages, but perhaps someone still lives there." Shalmarain. To these children of two races, so widely differing in culture and history, this was indeed a name of magic. In all the long story of Earth, there had been no greater epic than the defense of Shalmarain against an invader who had conquered all the universe. Though the true facts were utterly lost in the mists which had gathered so thickly around the Dawn Ages, the legends had never been forgotten and would last as long as man endured. Presently Hilvar's voice came again out of the darkness. "The people of the south could tell us more. I have some friends there. I will call them in the morning." Alvin scarcely heard him. He was deep in his own thoughts, trying to remember all that he had ever heard of Shalmarain. It was little enough. After this immense lapse of time, no one could tell the truth from the legend. All that was certain was that the Battle of Shalmarain marked the end of man's conquests and the beginning of his long decline. Among those mountains, thought Alvin, might lie the answers to all the problems that had tormented him for so many years. "How long," he said to Hilvar, "would it take us to reach the fortress?" "I've never been there, but it's much farther than I intended to go. I doubt if we could do it in a day." "Can't we use the ground car?" "No. The way lies through the mountains, and no cars can go there." Alvin thought it over. He was tired, his feet were sore, and the muscles of his thighs were still aching from the unaccustomed effort. It was very tempting to leave it for another time, yet there might be no other time. Beneath the dim light of the falling stars, not a few of which had died since Shalmarain was built, Alvin wrestled with his thoughts, and presently made his decision. Nothing had changed. The mountains resumed their watch over the sleeping land. But a turning point in history had come and gone, and the human race was moving toward a strange new future. Alvin and Hilvar slept no more that night, but broke camp with the first glow of dawn. The hill was drenched with dew, and Alvin marveled at the sparkling jewelry which weighed down each blade and leaf. The swish of the wet grass fascinated him as he ploughed through it, and looking back up the hill, he could see his path stretching behind him like a dark band across the shining ground. The sun had just lifted above the eastern wall of Lys when they reached the outskirts of the forest. Here, nature had returned to her own. Even Hilvar seemed somewhat lost among the gigantic trees that blocked the sunlight and cast pools of shadow on the jungle floor. Fortunately, the river from the falls flowed south in a line too straight to be altogether natural, and by keeping to its edge, they could avoid the denser undergrowth. A good deal of Hilvar's time was spent in controlling Krif, who disappeared occasionally into the jungle or went skimming wildly across the water. Even Alvin, to whom everything was still so new, could feel that the forest had a fascination not possessed by the smaller, more cultivated woods of northern Lys. Few trees were alike. Most of them were in various stages of devolution, and some had reverted through the ages almost to their original natural forms. Many were obviously not of Earth at all, probably not even of the solar system. Watching like sentinels over the lesser trees were giant sequoias, 300 or 400 feet high. Once they had been called the oldest things on Earth. They were still a little older than man. The river was widening now. Ever and again it opened into small lakes, upon which tiny islands lay at anchor. There were insects here, brilliantly coloured creatures swinging to and fro over the surface of the water. Once, despite Hilvar's commands, Krif darted away to join his distant cousins. He disappeared instantly in a cloud of glittering wings, and the sound of angry buzzing floated toward them. A moment later, the cloud erupted and Krif came back across the water, almost too quickly for the eye to follow. Thereafter he kept very close to Hilvar and did not stray again. Toward evening they caught occasional glimpses of the mountains ahead. The river that had been so faithful a guide was flowing sluggishly now, as if it too were nearing the end of its journey. But it was clear that they could not reach the mountains by nightfall. Well before sunset, the forest had become so dark that further progress was impossible. The great trees lay in pools of shadow, and a cold wind was sweeping through the leaves. Alvin and Hilvar settled down for the night beside a giant redwood whose topmost branches were still ablaze with sunlight. When at last the hidden sun went down, the light still lingered on the dancing waters. The two explorers, for such they now considered themselves, and such indeed they were, lay in the gathering gloom, watching the river and thinking of all that they had seen. Presently, Alvin felt once again steal over him that sense of delicious drowsiness he had known for the first time on the previous night, and he gladly resigned himself to sleep. It might not be needed in the effortless life of Diaspora, but he welcomed it here. In the final moment before unconsciousness overcame him, he found himself wondering who last had come this way, and how long since. The sun was high when they left the forest and stood at last before the mountain walks of Lys. Ahead of them, the ground rose steeply to the sky in waves of barren rock. Here the river came to an end, as spectacular as its beginning, for the ground opened in its path and it sank, roaring from sight. Alvin wondered what happened to it, and through what subterranean caves it travelled before it emerged again into the light of day. Perhaps the lost oceans of Earth still existed, far down in the eternal darkness, and this ancient river still felt the call that drew it to the sea. For a moment, Hilvar stood looking at the whirlpool and the broken land beyond. Then he pointed to a gap in the hills. "Shalmaraine lies in that direction," he said confidently. Alvin did not ask how he knew. He assumed that Hilvar's mind had made brief contact with that of a friend many miles away, and the information he needed had been silently passed to him. It did not take long to reach the gap, and when they had passed through it, they found themselves facing a curious plateau with gently sloping sides. Alvin felt no tiredness now, and no fear, only a taut expectancy and a sense of approaching adventure. What he would discover, he had no conception. That he would discover something, he did not doubt at all. As they approached the summit, the nature of the ground altered abruptly. The lower slopes had consisted of porous volcanic stone, piled here and there in great mounds of slag. Now the surface turned suddenly to hard, glassy sheets, smooth and treacherous, as if the rock had once run in molten rivers down the mountain. The rim of the plateau was almost at their feet. Hilvar reached it first, and a few seconds later, Alvin overtook him and stood speechless at his side. For they stood on the edge, not of the plateau they had expected, but of a giant bowl, half a mile deep and 3 miles in diameter. Ahead of them, the ground plunged steeply downward, slowly levelling out at the bottom of the valley and rising again more and more steeply to the opposite rim. The lowest part of the bowl was occupied by a circular lake, the surface of which trembled continually, as if agitated by incessant waves. Although it lay in the full glare of the sun, the whole of that great depression was ebony black. What material formed the crater, Alvin and Hilvar could not even guess, but it was black as the rock of a world that had never known a sun. Nor was that all, for lying beneath their feet and ringing the entire crater was a seamless band of metal, some 100 feet wide, tarnished by immeasurable age, but still showing no slightest sign of corrosion. As their eyes grew accustomed to the unearthly scene, Alvin and Hilvar realized that the blackness of the bowl was not as absolute as they had thought. Here and there, so fugitive that they could only see them indirectly, tiny explosions of light were flickering in the ebony walls. They came at random, vanishing as soon as they were born, like the reflections of stars on a broken sea. "It's wonderful," gasped Alvin. "But what is it?"
"It looks like a reflector of some kind."
"But it's so black."
"Only to our eyes, remember. We do not know what radiations they used."
"But surely there must be more than this. Where is the fortress?"
Hilvar pointed to the lake.
"Look carefully,"
he said. Alvin stared through the quivering roof of the lake, trying to plumb the secrets it concealed within its depths. At first he could see nothing. Then, in the shallows near its edge, he made out a faint reticulation of light and shade. He was able to trace the pattern out toward the center of the lake until the deepening water hid all further details. The dark lake had engulfed the fortress. Down there lay the ruins of once mighty buildings overthrown by time. Yet not all of them had been submerged, for on the far side of the crater, Alvin now noticed piles of jumbled stones and great blocks that must once have formed part of massive walls. The waters lapped around them, but had not yet risen far enough to complete their victory.
"We'll go around the lake," said Hilvar, speaking softly, as if the majestic desolation had struck awe into his soul. "Perhaps we may find something in those ruins over there."
For the first few 100 yards, the crater walls were so steep and smooth that it was difficult to stand upright. But after a while they reached the gentler slopes and could walk without difficulty. Near the border of the lake, the smooth ebony of the surface was concealed by a thin layer of soil, which the winds of Lys must have brought here through the ages. A quarter of a mile away, titanic blocks of stone were piled one upon the other, like the discarded toys of an infant giant. Here, a section of a massive wall was still recognizable. There, 2 carven obelisks marked what had once been a mighty entrance. Everywhere grew mosses and creeping plants, and tiny stunted trees. Even the wind was hushed. So Alvin and Hilvar came to the ruins of Shalmarain. Against those walls, and against the energies they had housed, forces that could shatter a world to dust had flamed and thundered, and been utterly defeated. Once these peaceful skies had blazed with fires torn from the hearts of suns, and the mountains of Lys must have quailed like living things beneath the fury of their masters. No one had ever captured Shalmarain. But now the fortress, the impregnable fortress, had fallen at last, captured and destroyed by the patient tendrils of the ivy, the generations of blindly burrowing worms, and the slowly rising waters of the lake. Overawed by its majesty, Alvin and Hilvar walked in silence toward the colossal wreck. They passed into the shadow of a broken wall and entered a canyon where the mountains of stone had split asunder. Before them lay the lake,
and presently they stood with the dark water lapping at their feet. Tiny waves, no more than a few inches high, broke endlessly upon the narrow shore. Hilvar was the first to speak, and his voice held a hint of uncertainty which made Alvin glance at him in sudden surprise.
"There's something here I don't understand," he said slowly. "There's no wind, so what causes these ripples? The water should be perfectly still."
Before Alvin could think of any reply, Hilvar dropped to the ground, turned his head on one side, and immersed his right ear in the water. Alvin wondered what he hoped to discover in such a ludicrous position. Then he realized that he was listening. With some repugnance, for the rayless waters looked singularly uninviting, he followed Hilvar's example. The first shock of coldness lasted only for a second. When it passed, he could hear, faint but distinct, a steady, rhythmic throbbing. It was as if he could hear, from far down in the depths of the lake, the beating of a giant heart. They shook the water from their hair and stared at each other with silent surmise. Neither liked to say what he thought, that the lake was alive.
"It would be best," said Hilvar presently, "if we searched among these ruins and kept away from the lake."
"Do you think there's something down there?" asked Alvin, pointing to the enigmatic ripples that were still breaking against his feet. "Could it be dangerous?"
"Nothing that possesses a mind is dangerous," Hilvar replied.
"Is that true?" thought Alvin. "What of the invaders?"
"I can detect no thoughts of any kind here. But I do not believe we are alone. It is very strange."
They walked slowly back toward the ruins of the fortress, each carrying in his mind the sound of that steady, muffled pulsing. It seemed to Alvin that mystery was piling upon mystery, and that for all his efforts he was getting further and further from any understanding of the truths he sought. It did not seem that the ruins could teach them anything, but they searched carefully among the piles of rubble and the great mounds of stone. Here, perhaps, lay the graves of buried machines, the machines that had done their work so long ago. They would be useless now, thought Alvin, if the invaders returned.
Why had they never come back?
But that was yet another mystery. He had enough enigmas to deal with. There was no need to seek for any more. A few yards from the lake, they found a small clearing among the rubble. It had been covered with weeds, but they were now blackened and charred by tremendous heat, so that they crumbled to ashes as Alvin and Hilvar approached, smearing their legs with streaks of charcoal. At the center of the clearing stood a metal tripod, firmly anchored to the ground, and supporting a circular ring which was tilted on its axis so that it pointed to a spot halfway up the sky. At first sight, it seemed that the ring enclosed nothing. Then, as Alvin looked more carefully, he saw that it was filled with a faint haze that tormented the eye by lurking at the edge of the visible spectrum. It was the glow of power, and from this mechanism, he did not doubt, had come the explosion of light that had lured them to Shalmarain. They did not venture any closer, but stood looking at the machine from a safe distance. They were on the right track, thought Alvin. Now it only remained to discover who, or what, had set this apparatus here, and what their purpose might be. That tilted ring, it was clearly aimed out into space. Had the flash they had observed been some kind of signal? That was a thought which had breathtaking implications.
"Alvin,"
said Hilvar suddenly, his voice quiet but urgent.
"We have visitors."
Alvin spun on his heels and found himself staring at a triangle of lidless eyes. That, at least, was his first impression. Then behind the staring eyes, he saw the outlines of a small but complex machine. It was hanging in the air a few feet above the ground, and it was like no robot he had ever before seen. Once the initial surprise had worn off, he felt himself the complete master of the situation. All his life, he had given orders to machines, and the fact that this one was unfamiliar was of no importance. For that matter, he had never seen more than a few percent of the robots that provided his daily needs in Diaspora. "Can you speak?" he asked. There was silence. Is anyone controlling you? Still silence. Go away. Come here. Rise. Fall. None of the conventional control thoughts produced any effect. The machine remained contemptuously inactive. That suggested two possibilities. It was either too unintelligent to understand him, or it was very intelligent indeed, with its own powers of choice and volition. In that case, he must treat it as an equal. Even then he might underestimate it, but it would bear him no resentment, for conceit was not a vice from which robots often suffered. Hilvar could not help laughing at Alvin's obvious discomfiture. He was just about to suggest that he should take over the task of communicating when the words died on his lips. The stillness of Shalmarain was shattered by an ominous and utterly unmistakable sound, the gurgling splash of a very large body emerging from water. It was the second time since he had left Diaspora that Alvin wished he were at home. Then he remembered that this was not the spirit in which to meet adventure, and he began to walk slowly but deliberately toward the lake. The creature now emerging from the dark water seemed a monstrous parody, in living matter, of the robot that was still subjecting them to its silent scrutiny. That same equilateral arrangement of eyes could be no coincidence. Even the pattern of tentacles and little jointed limbs had been roughly reproduced. Beyond that, however, the resemblance ceased. The robot did not possess, it obviously did not require, the fringe of delicate, feathery palps which beat the water with a steady rhythm, the stubby multiple legs on which the beast was humping itself ashore, or the ventilating inlets, if that was what they were, which now wheezed fitfully in the thin air. Most of the creature's body remained in the water. Only the first 10 feet reared itself into what was clearly an alien element. The entire beast was about 50 feet long, and even anyone with no knowledge of biology would have realized that there was something altogether wrong about it. It had an extraordinary air of improvisation and careless design, as if its components had been manufactured without much forethought and thrown roughly together when the need arose. Despite its size and their initial doubts, neither Alvin nor Hilvar felt the slightest nervousness once they had had a clear look at the dweller in the lake. There was an engaging clumsiness about the creature which made it quite impossible to regard it as a serious menace, even if there was any reason to suppose it might be dangerous. The human race had long ago overcome its childhood terror of the merely alien in appearance. That was a fear which could no longer survive after the first contact with friendly extraterrestrial races. "Let me deal with this," said Hilvar quietly. "I'm used to handling animals." "But this isn't an animal," whispered Alvin in return. "I'm sure it's intelligent and owns that robot."
"The robot may own it. In any case, its mentality must be very strange. I can still detect no sign of thought. Hello? What's happening?"
The monster had not moved from its half-raised position at the water's edge, which it seemed to be maintaining with considerable effort. But a semi-transparent membrane had begun to form at the center of the triangle of eyes, a membrane that pulsed and quivered and presently started to emit audible sounds. They were low-pitched, resonant boomings which created no intelligible words, though it was obvious that the creature was trying to speak to them. It was painful to watch this desperate attempt at communication. For several minutes the creature struggled in vain. Then quite suddenly, it seemed to realize that it had made a mistake. The throbbing membrane contracted in size, and the sounds it emitted rose several octaves in frequency until they entered the spectrum of normal speech. Recognizable words began to form, though they were still interspersed with gibberish. It was as if the creature was remembering a vocabulary it had known long ago, but had had no occasion to use for many years. Hilvar tried to give what assistance he could.
"We can understand you now," he said,
speaking slowly and distinctly.
"Can we help you? We saw the light you made. It brought us here from Lys."
At the word Lys, the creature seemed to droop as if it had suffered some bitter disappointment. Liss, it repeated. It could not manage the S very well, so that the word sounded like lid.
Always from Liss. No one else ever comes. We call the great ones, but they do not hear.
Who are the great ones?
Asked Alvin, leaning forward eagerly. The delicate, ever-moving palps waved briefly toward the sky.
The great ones, it said. From the planets of eternal day. They will come. The Master promised us.
This did not seem to make matters any clearer. Before Alvin could continue his cross-examination, Hilvar intervened again. His questioning was so patient, so sympathetic, and yet so penetrating, that Alvin knew better than to interrupt, despite his eagerness. He did not like to admit that Hilvar was his superior in intelligence, but there was no doubt that his flair for handling animals extended even to this fantastic being. What was more, it seemed to respond to him. Its speech became more distinct as the conversation proceeded, and where at first it had been brusque to the point of rudeness, it presently elaborated its answers and volunteered information on its own. Alvin lost all consciousness of the passage of time as Hilvar pieced together the incredible story. They could not discover the whole truth. There was endless room for conjecture and debate. As the creature answered Hilvar's questions ever more and more willingly, its appearance began to change. It slumped back into the lake, and the stubby legs that had been supporting it seemed to dissolve into the rest of its body. Presently, a still more extraordinary change occurred. The three huge eyes slowly closed, shrank to pinpoints, and vanished completely. It was as if the creature had seen all that it wished to for the moment, and therefore had no further use for eyes. Other and more subtle alterations were continually taking place, and eventually, almost all that remained above the surface of the water was the vibrating diaphragm through which the creature spoke. Doubtless this too would be dissolved back into the original amorphous mass of protoplasm when it was no longer required. Alvin found it hard to believe that intelligence could reside in so unstable a form, and his biggest surprise was yet to come. Though it seemed obvious that the creature was not of terrestrial origin, it was some time before even Hilvar, despite his greater knowledge of biology, realized the type of organism they were dealing with. It was not a single entity. In all their conversations with it, it always referred to itself as we. In fact, it was nothing less than a colony of independent creatures organized and controlled by unknown forces. Animals of a remotely similar type, the Medusae, for example, had once flourished in the ancient oceans of Earth. Some of them had been of great size, trailing their translucent bodies in forests of stinging tentacles over 50 or 100 feet of water. But none of them had attained even the faintest flicker of intelligence, beyond the power to react to simple stimuli. There was certainly intelligence here, though it was a failing, degenerating intelligence. Never was Alvin to forget this unearthly meeting, as Hilvar slowly pieced together the story of the Master. While the protean polyp groped for unfamiliar words, the dark lake lapped at the ruins of Shalmarane, and the trioptic robot watched them with unwavering eyes. Chapter 13. The Master had come to Earth amid the chaos of the transition centuries, when the Galactic Empire was crumbling, but the lines of communication among the stars had not yet completely broken. He had been of human origin, though his home was a planet circling one of the seven suns. While still a young man, he had been forced to leave his native world, and its memory had haunted him all his life. His expulsion he blamed on vindictive enemies, but the fact was that he suffered from an incurable malady which, it seemed, attacked only Homo sapiens, among all the intelligent races of the universe. That disease was religious mania. Throughout the earlier part of its history, the human race had brought forth an endless succession of prophets, seers, messiahs, and evangelists who convinced themselves and their followers that to them alone were the secrets of the universe revealed. Some of them succeeded in establishing religions that survived for many generations and influenced billions of men. Others were forgotten even before their deaths. The rise of science, which with monotonous regularity refuted the cosmologies of the prophets and produced miracles which they could never match, eventually destroyed all these faiths. It did not destroy the awe nor the reverence and humility which all intelligent beings felt as they contemplated the stupendous universe in which they found themselves. What it did weaken, and finally obliterate, were the countless religions, each of which claimed with unbelievable arrogance that it was the sole repository of the truth, and that its millions of rivals and predecessors were all mistaken. Yet, though they never possessed any real power once humanity had reached a very elementary level of civilization, all down the ages isolated cults had continued to appear, and however fantastic their creeds, they had always managed to attract some disciples. They thrived with particular strength during periods of confusion and disorder, and it was not surprising that the transition centuries had seen a great outburst of irrationality. When reality was depressing, men tried to console themselves with myths. The master, even if he was expelled from his own world, did not leave it unprovided. The seven suns had been the center of galactic power and science, and he must have possessed influential friends. He had made his hegira in a small but speedy ship, reputed to be one of the fastest ever built. With him into exile, he had taken another of the ultimate products of galactic science, the robot that was looking at Alvin and Hilvar even now. No one had ever known the full talents and functions of this machine. To some extent, indeed, it had become the master's alter ego. Without it, the religion of the Great Ones would probably have collapsed after the master's death. Together they had roved among the star clouds on a zigzag trail, which led at last, certainly not by accident, back to the world from which the master's ancestors had sprung. Entire libraries had been written about that saga, each work therein inspiring a host of commentaries until, by a kind of chain reaction, the original volumes were lost beneath mountains of exegesis and annotation. The master had stopped at many worlds, and made disciples among many races. His personality must have been an immensely powerful one for it to have inspired humans and non-humans alike, and there was no doubt that a religion of such wide appeal must have contained much that was fine and noble. Probably the master was the most successful, as he was also the last, of all mankind's messiahs. None of his predecessors could have won so many converts or had their teachings carried across such gulfs of time and space. What those teachings were, neither Alvin nor Hilvar could ever discover with any accuracy. The great polyp did its desperate best to convey them, but many of the words it used were meaningless, and it had a habit of repeating sentences or whole speeches with a kind of swift mechanical delivery that made them very hard to follow. After a while, Hilvar did his best to steer the conversation away from these meaningless morasses of theology in order to concentrate on ascertainable facts. The master and a band of his most faithful followers had arrived on Earth in the days before the cities had passed away, and while the port of Diaspora was still open to the stars. They must have come in ships of many kinds, the polyps, for example, in one filled with the waters of the sea, which was their natural home. Whether the movement was well received on Earth was not certain, but at least it met no violent opposition, and after further wanderings, it set up its final retreat among the forests and mountains of Lys. At the close of his long life, the master's thoughts had turned once more toward the home from which he had been exiled, and he had asked his friends to carry him out into the open so that he could watch the stars. He had waited, his strength waning, until the culmination of the seven suns. And toward the end, he babbled many things which were to inspire yet more libraries of interpretation in future ages. Again and again he spoke of the great ones who had now left this universe of space and matter, but who would surely one day return, and he charged his followers to remain to greet them when they came. Those were his last rational words. He was never again conscious of his surroundings, But just before the end, he uttered one phrase that had come down the ages to haunt the minds of all who heard it. "It is lovely to watch the coloured shadows on the planets of eternal light." Then he died. At the Master's death, many of his followers broke away, but others remained faithful to his teachings, which they slowly elaborated through the ages. At first they believed that the Great Ones, whoever they were, would soon return, but that hope faded with the passing centuries. The story here grew very confused, and it seemed that truth and legend were inextricably intertwined. Alvin had only a vague picture of generations of fanatics waiting for some great event which they did not understand to take place at some unknown future date. The Great Ones never returned. Slowly the power of the movement failed as death and disillusion robbed it of its disciples. The short-lived human followers were the first to go, and there was something supremely ironic in the fact that the very last adherent of a human prophet was a creature utterly unlike man. The great Polyp had become the Master's last disciple for a very simple reason. It was immortal. The billions of individual cells from which its body was built would die, but before that happened, they would have reproduced themselves. At long intervals, the monster would disintegrate into its myriad separate cells, which would go their own way and multiply by fission if their environment was suitable. During this phase, the polyp did not exist as a self-conscious, intelligent entity. Here, Alvin was irresistibly reminded of the manner in which the inhabitants of Diaspora spent their quiescent millenniums in the city's memory banks. In due time, some mysterious biological force brought the scattered components together again, and the polyp began a new cycle of existence. It returned to awareness and recollected its earlier lives, though often imperfectly, since accidents sometimes damaged the cells that carried the delicate patterns of memory. Perhaps no other form of life could have kept faith so long to a creed otherwise forgotten for a billion years. In a sense, the great polyp was a helpless victim of its biological nature. Because of its immortality, it could not change, but was forced to repeat eternally the same invariant pattern. The religion of the Great Ones, in its later stages, had become identified with the veneration of the Seven Suns. When the Great Ones stubbornly refused to appear, attempts were made to signal their distant home. Long ago, the signaling had become no more than a meaningless ritual, now maintained by an animal that had forgotten how to learn and a robot that had never known how to forget. As the immeasurably ancient voice died away into the still air, Alvin found himself overwhelmed by a surge of pity. The misplaced devotion, the loyalty that had held to its futile course while suns and planets passed away. He could never have believed such a tale had he not seen the evidence before his eyes. More than ever before, the extent of his ignorance saddened him. A tiny fragment of the past had been illuminated for a little while, but now the darkness had closed over it again. The history of the universe must be a mass of such disconnected threads, and no one could say which were important and which were trivial. This fantastic tale of the Master and the Great Ones seemed like another of the countless legends that had somehow survived from the civilizations of the dawn. Yet the very existence of the huge polyp, and of the silently watching robot, made it impossible for Alvin to dismiss the whole story as a fable built of self-delusion upon a foundation of madness. What was the relationship, he wondered, between these two entities, which, though so different in every possible way, had maintained their extraordinary partnership over such eons of time? He was somehow certain that the robot was much the more important of the two. It had been the confidant of the Master, and must still know all his secrets. Alvin looked at the enigmatic machine that still regarded him so steadily. Why would it not speak? What thoughts were passing through its complicated and perhaps alien mind? Yet, surely, if it had been designed to serve the Master, its mind would not be altogether alien, and it should respond to human orders. As he thought of all the secrets which that stubbornly mute machine must possess, Alvin felt a curiosity so great that it verged upon greed. It seemed unfair that such knowledge should be wasted and hidden from the world. Here must lie wonders beyond even the ken of the central computer in Diaspora. "Why won't your robot speak to us?" he asked the polyp, when Hilvar had momentarily run out of questions. The answer was one he had half expected.
"It was against the Master's wishes for it to speak with any voice but his, and his voice is silent now."
"But it will obey you?"
"Yes. The Master placed it in our charge. We can see through its eyes wherever it goes. It watches over the machines that preserve this lake and keep its water pure. Yet it would be truer to call it our partner than our servant."
Alvin thought this over. An idea, still vague and half-formed, was beginning to take shape in his mind. Perhaps it was inspired by pure lust for knowledge and power. When he looked back on this moment, he could never be certain just what his motives were. They might be largely selfish, but they also contained some element of compassion. If he could do so, he would like to break this futile sequence and release these creatures from their fantastic fate. He was not sure what could be done about the polyp, but it might be possible to cure the robot of its insanity and at the same time to release its priceless pent-up memories. "Are you certain?" he said, slowly talking to the polyp, but aiming his words at the robot. "That you are really carrying out the Master's wishes by remaining here? He desired the world to know of his teaching, but they have been lost while you hide here in Shalmarane. It was only by chance that we discovered you, and there may be many others who would like to hear the doctrine of the Great Ones." Hilvar glanced at him sharply, obviously uncertain of his intentions. The polyp seemed agitated, and the steady beating of its respiratory equipment faltered for a few seconds. Then it replied, in a voice not altogether under control,
"We have discussed this problem for many years, but we cannot leave Shalmarane, so the world must come to us, no matter how long it takes."
"I have a better idea," said Alvin eagerly. "It is true that you may have to stay here in the lake, but there is no reason why your companion should not come with us. He can return whenever he wishes or whenever you need him. Many things have changed since the Master died, things which you should know about, but which you can never understand if you stay here." The robot never moved, but in its agony of indecision, the polyp sank completely below the surface of the lake and remained there for several minutes. Perhaps it was having a soundless argument with its colleague. Several times it began to re-emerge, thought better of it, and sank into the water again. Hilvar took this opportunity to exchange a few words with Alvin.
"I'd like to know what you are trying to do," he said softly,
his voice half bantering and half serious.
"Or don't you know yourself?"
"Surely," replied Alvin, "you feel sorry for these poor creatures. Don't you think it would be a kindness to rescue them?"
"I do, but I've learned enough about you to be fairly certain that altruism isn't one of your dominant emotions. You must have some other motive."
Alvin smiled ruefully. Even if Hilvar did not read his mind, and he had no reason to suppose that he did, he could undoubtedly read his character.
"Your people have remarkable mental powers," he replied,
trying to divert the conversation from dangerous ground.
"I think they might be able to do something for the robot, if not this animal."
He spoke very softly, lest he be overheard. The precaution might have been a useless one, but if the robot did intercept his remarks, it gave no sign of it. Fortunately, before Hilvar could press the inquiry any further, the polyp emerged once more from the lake. In the last few minutes it had become a good deal smaller, and its movements were more disorganized. Even as Alvin watched, a segment of its complex, translucent body broke away from the main bulk, and then disintegrated into multitudes of smaller sections, which swiftly dispersed. The creature was beginning to break up before their eyes. Its voice, when it spoke again, was very erratic and hard to understand.
"Next cycle starting,"
it jerked out in a kind of fluctuating whisper.
Did not expect it so soon. Only few minutes left. Stimulation too great. Cannot hold together much longer.
Alvin and Hilvar stared at the creature in horrified fascination. Even though the process they were watching was a natural one, it was not pleasant to watch an intelligent creature apparently in its death throes. They also felt an obscure sense of guilt. It was irrational to have the feeling, since it was of no great importance when the polyp began another cycle, but they realized that the unusual effort and excitement caused by their presence was responsible for this premature metamorphosis. Alvin realized that he would have to act quickly, or his opportunity would be gone. Perhaps only for a few years, perhaps for centuries.
"What have you decided?" he said eagerly. "Is the robot coming with us?"
There was an agonizing pause while the polyp tried to force its dissolving body to obey its will. The speech diaphragm fluttered, but no audible sound came from it. Then, as if in a despairing gesture of farewell, it waved its delicate palps feebly and let them fall back into the water, where they promptly broke adrift and went floating out into the lake. In a matter of minutes, the transformation was over. Nothing of the creature larger than an inch across remained. The water was full of tiny greenish specks, which seemed to have a life and mobility of their own, and which rapidly disappeared into the vastness of the lake. The ripples on the surface had now altogether died away, and Alvin knew that the steady pulse beat that had sounded in the depths would now be stilled. The lake was dead again, or so it seemed. But that was an illusion. One day the unknown forces that had never failed to do their duty in the past would exert themselves again, and the polyp would be reborn. It was a strange and wonderful phenomenon. Yet was it so much stranger than the organization of the human body, itself a vast colony of separate living cells? Alvin wasted little effort on such speculations. He was oppressed by his sense of failure, even though he had never clearly conceived the goal he was aiming for. A dazzling opportunity had been missed and might never again return. He stared sadly out across the lake, and it was some time before his mind registered the message which Hilvar was speaking quietly in his ear.
"Alvin," his friend said softly, "I think you have won your point."
He spun swiftly on his heels. The robot, which until now had been floating aloofly in the distance, never approaching within 20 feet of them, had moved up in silence and was now poised a yard above his head. Its unmoving eyes, with their wide angles of vision, gave no indication of its direction of interest. Probably it saw the entire hemisphere in front of it with equal clarity, but Alvin had little doubt that its attention was now focused upon him. It was waiting for his next move. To some extent, at least, it was now under his control. It might follow him to Lys, perhaps even to Diaspora, unless it changed its mind. Until then, he was its probationary master. Chapter 14. The journey back to Early lasted almost 3 days, partly because Alvin, for his own reasons, was in no hurry to return. The physical exploration of Lys had now taken second place to a more important and exciting project. He was slowly making contact with the strange, obsessed intelligence which had now become his companion. He suspected that the robot was trying to use him for its own purposes, which would be no more than poetic justice. What its motives were, he could never be quite certain, since it still stubbornly refused to speak to him. For some reason of his own, perhaps fear that it might reveal too many of his secrets, the master must have placed very efficient blocks upon its speech circuits, and Alvin's attempts to clear them were completely unsuccessful. Even in direct questioning of the "if you say nothing, I shall assume you mean yes" type failed. The robot was much too intelligent to be taken in by such simple tricks. In other respects, however, it was more cooperative. It would obey any orders that did not require it to speak or reveal information. After a while, Alvin found that he could control it, as he could direct the robots in diaspora by thought alone. This was a great step forward, and a little later the creature, it was hard to think of it as a mere machine, relaxed its guard still further and allowed him to see through its eyes. It did not object, it seemed, to such passive forms of communication, but it blocked all attempts at closer intimacy. Hilvar's existence it ignored completely. It would obey none of his commands, and its mind was closed to all his probing. At first, this was something of a disappointment to Alvin, who had hoped that Hilvar's greater mental powers would enable him to force open this treasure chest of hidden memories. It was not until later that he realized the advantage of possessing a servant who would obey no one else in all the world. The member of the expedition who strongly objected to the robot was Criff. Perhaps he imagined that he now had a rival, or perhaps he disapproved on general principles of anything that flew without wings. When no one was looking, he had made several direct assaults on the robot, which had infuriated him still further by taking not the slightest notice of his attacks. Eventually, Hilvar had been able to calm him down, and on the homeward journey in the ground car, he seemed to have resigned himself to the situation. Robot and insect escorted the vehicle as it glided silently through forest and field, each keeping to the side of its respective master and pretending that its rival was not there. Serenus was already waiting for them as the car floated into Airlie. It was impossible, Alvin thought, to surprise these people. Their interlinked minds kept them in touch with everything that was happening in their land. He wondered how they had reacted to his adventures in Shalmarane, which presumably everyone in Lys now knew about. Serenus seemed to be worried and more uncertain than he had ever seen her before, and Alvin remembered the choice that now lay before him. In the excitement of the last few days, he had almost forgotten it. He did not like to spend energy worrying about problems that still lay in the future. But the future was now upon him. He must decide in which of these two worlds he wished to live. The voice of Serenus was troubled when she began to speak, and Alvin had the sudden impression that something had gone awry with the plans that Lys had been making for him. What had been happening during his absence? Had emissaries gone into diaspora to tamper with Kedron's mind? And had they failed in their duty? Alvin, began Serenus, there are many things I did not tell you before, but which you must now learn if you are to understand our actions. You know one of the reasons for the isolation of our two races. The fear of the invaders, that dark shadow in the depths of every human mind, turned your people against the world and made them lose themselves in their own dreams. Here in Lys, that fear has never been so great, though we bore the burden of the final attack. We had a better reason for our actions, and what we did with open eyes. Long ago, Alvin, men sought immortality, and at last achieved it. They forgot that a world which had banished death must also banish life. The power to extend his life indefinitely might bring contentment to the individual, but brought stagnation to the race. Ages ago we sacrificed our immortality, but diaspora still follows the false dream. That is why our ways parted, and why they must never meet again. Although the words had been more than half expected, the blow seemed none the less for its anticipation. Yet Alvin refused to admit the failure of all his plans, half-formed though they were, and only part of his brain was listening to Serenus now. He understood and noted all her words, but the conscious portion of his mind was retracing the road to diaspora, trying to imagine every obstacle that could be placed in his way. Serenus was clearly unhappy. Her voice was almost pleading as it spoke, and Alvin knew that she was talking not only to him, but to her son. She must be aware of the understanding and affection that had grown up between them during the days they had spent together. Hilvar was watching his mother intently as she spoke, and it seemed to Alvin that his gaze held not merely concern, but also more than a trace of censure. "We do not wish to make you do anything against your will, but you must surely realize what it would mean if our people met again. Between our culture and yours is a gulf as great as any that ever separated Earth from its ancient colonies. Think of this one fact, Alvin. You and Hilvar are now of nearly the same age. But both he and I will have been dead for centuries, while you are still a youth. And this is only your first in an infinite series of lives. The room was very quiet, so quiet that Alvin could hear the strange plaintive cries of unknown beasts in the fields beyond the village. Presently, he said, almost in a whisper, "What do you want me to do?" "We hoped that we could give you the choice of staying here or returning to Diaspora. But now that is impossible. Too much has happened for us to leave the decision in your hands. Even in the short time you have been here, your influence has been highly disturbing. No, I am not reproving you. I am sure you intended no harm. But it would have been best to leave the creatures you met in Shalmarain to their own destiny. And as for Diaspora," Serranus gave a gesture of annoyance, "too many people know where you have gone. We did not act in time. What is most serious, the man who helped you discover Lys has vanished. Neither your council nor our agents can discover him, so he remains a potential danger to our security. Perhaps you are surprised that I am telling you all this, but it is quite safe for me to do so. I am afraid we have only one choice before us. We must send you back to Diaspora with a false set of memories. Those memories have been constructed with great care, and when you return home, you will know nothing of us. You will believe that you have had rather dull and dangerous adventures in gloomy underground caverns, where the roofs continually collapsed behind you, and you kept alive only through eating unappetizing weeds and drinking from occasional springs. For the rest of your life you will believe this to be the truth, and everyone in Diaspora will accept your story. There will be no mystery, then, to lure any future explorers. They will think they know all there is to be known about Lys." Serranus paused and looked at Alvin with anxious eyes. "We are very sorry that this is necessary, and ask your forgiveness while you still remember us. You may not accept our verdict, but we know many facts that are hidden from you. At least you will have no regrets, for you will believe that you have discovered all that there is to be found." Alvin wondered if that was true. He was not sure that he would ever settle down to the routine of life in Diaspora, even when he had convinced himself that nothing worthwhile existed beyond its walls. What was more, he had no intention of putting the matter to the test. "When do you wish me to undergo this treatment?" Alvin asked. "Immediately. We are ready now. Open your mind to me as you did before, and you will know nothing until you find yourself back in Diaspora." Alvin was silent for a while. Then he said quietly, "I would like to say goodbye to Hilvar." Serranus nodded. "I understand. I will leave you here for a while and return when you are ready." She walked over to the stairs that led down to the interior of the house and left them alone on the roof. It was some time before Alvin spoke to his friend. He felt a great sadness, yet also an unbroken determination not to permit the wreck of all his hopes. He looked once more down upon the village where he had found a measure of happiness, and which he might never see again if those who were ranged behind Serranus had their way. The ground car was still standing beneath one of the wide-branching trees, with the patient robot hanging in the air above it. A few children had gathered around to examine this strange newcomer, but none of the adults seemed in the least interested. "Hilvar," said Alvin abruptly, "I'm very sorry about this." "So am I," Hilvar answered, his voice unstable with emotion. "I had hoped that you could have remained here. Do you think that what Serranus wants to do is right?"
"Do not blame my mother. She is only doing as she is asked," replied Hilvar.
Though he had not answered his question, Alvin had not the heart to ask it again. It was unfair to put such a strain on his friend's loyalty.
"Then tell me this.
asked Alvin.
How could your people stop me if I tried to leave with my memories untouched?
It would be easy. If you tried to escape, we would take control of your mind and force you to come back.
Alvin had expected as much and was not discouraged. He wished that he could confide in Hilvar, who was obviously upset by their impending separation, but he dared not risk the failure of his plans. Very carefully, checking every detail, he traced out the only road that could lead him back to Diaspora on the terms he wished. There was one risk which he had to face, and against which he could do nothing to protect himself. If Serranus broke her promise and dipped into his mind, all his careful preparations might be in vain. He held out his hand to Hilvar, who grasped it firmly but seemed unable to speak.
"Let's go downstairs to meet Serranus," said Alvin. "I'd like to see some of the people in the village before I go."
Hilvar followed him silently into the peaceful coolness of the house, and then out through the hallway and onto the ring of colored glass that surrounded the building. Serranus was waiting for them there, looking calm and resolute. She knew that Alvin was trying to hide something from her, and thought again of the precautions she had taken. As a man may flex his muscles before some great effort, she ran through the compulsion patterns she might have to use.
"Are you ready, Alvin?" she asked.
"Quite ready,"
replied Alvin, and there was a tone in his voice that made her look at him sharply.
"Then it will be best if you make your mind a blank as you did before. You will feel and know nothing after that, until you find yourself back in Diaspora."
Alvin turned to Hilvar and said in a quick whisper that Serranus could not hear,
"Goodbye, Hilvar. Don't worry. I'll be back."
Then he faced Serranus again.
"I don't resent what you are trying to do," he said. "No doubt you believe it is for the best, but I think you are wrong. Diaspora and Lys should not remain apart forever. One day they may need each other desperately. So I am going home with all that I have learned. And I do not think that you can stop me."
He waited no longer, and it was just as well. Serranus never moved, but instantly he felt his body slipping from his control. The power that had brushed aside his own will was even greater than he had expected, and he realized that many hidden minds must be aiding Serranus. Helplessly, he began to walk back into the house, and for an awful moment, he thought his plan had failed. Then there came a flash of steel and crystal, and metal arms closed swiftly around him. His body fought against them, as he had known that it must do, but the struggles were useless. The ground fell away beneath him, and he caught a glimpse of Hilvar frozen by surprise, with a foolish smile upon his face. The robot was carrying him a dozen feet above the ground, much faster than a man could run. It took Serranus only a moment to understand his ruse, and his struggles died away as she relaxed her control. But she was not defeated yet, and presently there happened that which Alvin had feared and done his best to counteract. There were now two separate entities fighting inside his mind, and one of them was pleading with the robot, begging it to set him down. The real Alvin waited, breathlessly, resisting only a little against forces he knew he could not hope to fight. He had gambled. There was no way of telling beforehand if his uncertainty would obey orders as complex as those that he had given it. Under no circumstances, he had told the robot, must it obey any further commands of his until he was safely inside Diaspora. Those were the orders. If they were obeyed, Alvin had placed his fate beyond the reach of human interference. Never hesitating, the machine raced on along the path he had so carefully mapped out for it. A part of him was still pleading angrily to be released. But he knew now that he was safe. And presently, Serranus understood that too, for the forces inside his brain ceased to war with one another. Once more he was at peace, as ages ago an earlier wanderer had been when, lashed to the mast of his ship, he had heard the song of the sirens die away across the wine-dark sea. Chapter 15. Alvin did not relax until the chamber of the moving ways was around him once more. There had still been the danger that the people of Lys might be able to stop, or even to reverse, the vehicle in which he was travelling, and bring him back helplessly to his starting point. But his return was an uneventful repetition of the outward trip. 40 minutes after he had left Bliss, he was in the tomb of Yarlan Zay. The servants of the council were waiting for him, dressed in the formal black robes which they had not worn for centuries. Alvin felt no surprise and little alarm at the presence of this reception committee. He had now overcome so many obstacles that one more made little difference. He had learned a great deal since leaving Diaspora, and with that knowledge had come a confidence verging upon arrogance. Moreover, he now had a powerful, if erratic, ally. The best minds of Lys had been unable to interfere with his plans. Somehow, he believed that Diaspora could do no better. There were rational grounds for this belief, but it was based partly upon something beyond reason, a faith in his destiny which had slowly been growing in Alvin's mind. The mystery of his origin, his success in doing what no earlier man had ever done, the way in which new vistas had opened up before him, and the manner in which obstacles had failed to halt him, all these things added to his self-confidence. Faith in one's own destiny was among the most valuable of the gifts which the gods could bestow upon a man, but Alvin did not know how many it had led to utter disaster. "Alvin," said the leader of the city's proctors, "we have orders to accompany you wherever you go until the council has heard your case and rendered its verdict." "With what offence am I charged?" asked Alvin. He was still exhilarated by the excitement and elation of his escape from Lys, and could not yet take this new development very seriously. Presumably Kedron had talked. He felt a brief annoyance at the jester for betraying his secret.
"No charge has been made," came the reply. "If necessary, one will be framed after you have been heard."
"And when will that be?"
"Very soon, I imagine."
The proctor was obviously ill at ease, and was not sure how to handle his unwelcome assignment. At one moment, he would treat Alvin as a fellow citizen, and then he would remember his duties as a custodian and would adopt an attitude of exaggerated aloofness.
"This robot," he said abruptly, pointing to Alvin's companion. "Where did it come from? Is it one of ours?"
"No," replied Alvin. "I found it in Lys, the country I have been to. I have brought it here to meet the central computer." This calm statement produced a considerable commotion. The fact that there was something outside Diaspora was hard enough to accept, but that Alvin should have brought back one of its inhabitants and proposed to introduce it to the brain of the city was even worse. The proctors looked at each other with such helpless alarm that Alvin could hardly refrain from laughing at them. As they walked back through the park, his escort keeping discreetly at the rear and talking among itself in agitated whispers, Alvin considered his next move. The first thing he must do was to discover exactly what had happened during his absence. Kedron, Serranus had told him, had vanished. There were countless places where a man could hide in Diaspora. And since the jester's knowledge of the city was unsurpassed, it was not likely that he would be found until he chose to reappear. Perhaps, thought Alvin, he could leave a message where Kedron would be bound to see it and arrange a rendezvous. However, the presence of his guard might make that impossible. He had to admit that the surveillance was very discreet. By the time he had reached his apartment, he had almost forgotten the existence of the proctors. He imagined that they would not interfere with his movements unless he attempted to leave Diaspora, and for the time being, he had no intention of doing that. Indeed, he was fairly certain that it would be impossible to return to Lys by his original route. By this time, surely, the underground carrier system would have been put out of action by Serranus and her colleagues. The proctors did not follow him into his room. They knew that there was only the one exit, and stationed themselves outside that. Having had no instructions regarding the robot, they let it accompany Alvin. It was not a machine which they had any desire to interfere with, since its alien construction was obvious. From its behavior, they could not tell whether it was a passive servant of Alvin's or whether it was operating under its own volition. In view of this uncertainty, they were quite content to leave it severely alone. Once the wall had sealed itself behind him, Alvin materialized his favorite divan and threw himself down upon it.
luxuriating in his familiar surroundings, he called out of the memory units his last efforts in painting and sculpture, and examined them with a critical eye. If they had failed to satisfy him before, they were doubly displeasing now, and he could take no further pride in them. The person who had created them no longer existed. Into the few days he had been away from Diaspora, it seemed to Alvin that he had crowded the experience of a lifetime. He cancelled all these products of his adolescence, erasing them forever, and not merely returning them to the memory banks. The room was empty again, apart from the couch on which he was reclining, and the robot that still watched with wide, unfathomable eyes. What did the robot think of Diaspora? Wondered Alvin. Then he remembered that it was no stranger here, for it had known the city in the last days of its contact with the stars. Not until he felt thoroughly at home once more did Alvin begin to call his friends. He began with Ariston and Titania, though out of a sense of duty rather than any real desire to see and speak to them again. He was not sorry when their communicators informed him that they were unavailable, but he left them both a brief message announcing his return. This was quite unnecessary, since by now the whole city would know that he was back. However, he hoped that they would appreciate his thoughtfulness. He was beginning to learn consideration, though he had not yet realized that, like most virtues, it had little merit unless it was spontaneous and unself-conscious. Then, acting on a sudden impulse, he called the number that Kedron had given him so long ago in the Tower of Loran. He did not, of course, expect an answer, but there was always the possibility that Kedron had left a message. His guess was correct, but the message itself was shatteringly unexpected. The wall dissolved, and Kedron was standing before him. The jester looked tired and nervous, no longer the confident, slightly cynical person who had set Alvin on the path that led to Lys. There was a haunted look in his eyes, and he spoke as though he had very little time. "Alvin," he began, "this is a recording. Only you can receive it, but you can make what use of it you wish. It will not matter to me. When I got back to the tomb of Yarlan Zay, I found that Alistra had been following us. She must have told the council that you had left Diaspora, and that I had helped you. Very soon the proctors were looking for me, and I decided to go into hiding. I am used to that. I have done it before when some of my jests failed to be appreciated." There, thought Alvin, was a flash of the old Kedron. They could not have found me in 1,000 years, but someone else nearly did. There are strangers in Diaspora, Alvin. They could only have come from Lys, and they are looking for me. I do not know what this means, and I do not like it. The fact that they nearly caught me, though they are in a city that must be strange to them, suggests that they possess telepathic powers. I could fight the council, but this is an unknown peril which I do not care to face. I am therefore anticipating a step which I think the council might well force upon me, since it has been threatened before. I am going where no one can follow, and where I shall escape whatever changes are now about to happen to Diaspora. Perhaps I am foolish to do this. That is something which only time can prove. I shall know the answer one day. By now you will have guessed that I have gone back into the Hall of Creation, into the safety of the memory banks. Whatever happens, I put my trust in the central computer and the forces it controls for the benefit of Diaspora. If anything tampers with the central computer, we are all lost. If not, I have nothing to fear. To me, only a moment will seem to pass before I walk forth into Diaspora again, 50 or 100,000 years from now. I wonder what sort of city I shall find. It will be strange if you are there. Some day, I suppose, we will meet again. I cannot say whether I look forward to that meeting or fear it. I have never understood you, Alvin, though there was a time when I was vain enough to think I did. Only the central computer knows the truth, as it knows the truth about those other uniques who have appeared from time to time down the ages, and then were seen no more. Have you discovered what happened to them?
One reason, I suppose, why I am escaping into the future is because I am impatient. I want to see the results of what you have started, but I am anxious to miss the intermediate stages, which I suspect may be unpleasant. It will be interesting to see, in that world which will be around me in only a few minutes of apparent time from now, whether you are remembered as a creator or as a destroyer, or whether you are remembered at all. Goodbye, Alvin. I had thought of giving you some advice, but I do not suppose you would take it. You will go your own way, as you always have, and your friends will be tools to use or discard as occasion suits. That is all. I can think of nothing more to say.
For a moment, Kedron, the Kedron who no longer existed, save as a pattern of electric charges in the memory cells of the city, looked at Alvin with resignation and, it seemed, with sadness. Then the screen was blank again. Alvin remained motionless for a long time after the image of Kedron had faded. He was searching his soul as he had seldom done before in all his life, for he could not deny the truth of much that Kedron had said. When had he paused, in all his schemes and adventures, to consider the effect of what he was doing upon any of his friends? He had brought anxiety to them, and might soon bring worse, all because of his insatiable curiosity and the urge to discover what should not be known. He had never been fond of Kedron. The jester's astringent personality prevented any close relationship, even if Alvin had desired it. Yet now, as he thought of Kedron's parting words, he was shaken with remorse. Because of his actions, the jester had fled from this age into the unknown future. But surely, thought Alvin, he had no need to blame himself for that. It proved only what he had already known, that Kedron was a coward. Perhaps he was no more of a coward than anyone else in Diaspora, but he had the additional misfortune of possessing a powerful imagination. Alvin could accept some responsibility for his fate, but by no means all. Who else in Diaspora had he harmed or distressed? He thought of Jezerak, his tutor, who had been patient with what must have been his most difficult pupil. He remembered all the little kindnesses that his parents had shown him over the years. Now that he looked back upon them, there were more than he had imagined. And he thought of Alistra. She had loved him, and he had taken that love, or ignored it as he chose. Yet what else was he to have done? Would she have been any happier had he spurned her completely? He understood now why he had never loved Alistra or any of the women he had known in Diaspora. That was another lesson that Lys had taught him. Diaspora had forgotten many things, and among them was the true meaning of love. In Early he had watched the mothers dandling their children on their knees, and had himself felt that protective tenderness for all small and helpless creatures that is love's unselfish twin. Yet now there was no woman in Diaspora who knew or cared for what had once been the final aim of love. There were no real emotions, no deep passions in the immortal city. Perhaps such things only thrived because of their very transience, because they could not last forever and lay always under the shadow which Diaspora had banished. That was the moment, if such a moment ever existed, when Alvin realized what his destiny must be. Until now, he had been the unconscious agent of his own impulses. If he could have known so archaic an analogy, he might have compared himself to a rider on a runaway horse. It had taken him to many strange places, and might do so again, but in its wild galloping, it had shown him its powers, and taught him where he really wished to go. Alvin's reverie was rudely interrupted by the chimes of the wall screen. The timbre of the sound told him at once that this was no incoming call, but that someone had arrived to see him. He gave the admission signal, and a moment later was facing Jezerak. His tutor looked grave, but not unfriendly. "I have been asked to take you to the council, Alvin," he said. "It is waiting to hear you." Then Jezerak saw the robot and examined it curiously. "So this is the companion you have brought back from your travels. I think it had better come with us." This suited Alvin very well. The robot had already extricated him from one dangerous situation
and he might have to call upon it again. He wondered what the machine had thought about the adventures and vicissitudes in which he had involved it, and wished for the thousandth time that he could understand what was going on inside its closely shuttered mind.